Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host, and really glad you can be with us here on a hot summer day as the summer begins for us. Our topic today is family-owned businesses, and we'll get to that in just a minute, but I do want to remind you, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our programs, they're available through the new website on KUAR.org. We've changed over to the NPR format for our websites, so you'll find our program and its podcast information under Programs at KUAR.org, and you can just click on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. In every city in our nation, there are several successful businesses, and they all fall under the category of family-owned. And while it may be true that many of these businesses form the backbone of their respective cities and really are quite successful, there are also many family businesses that fail or are failing because they are family-owned. And really, we want to talk today about what makes these businesses successful or what makes them fail, and how does each successive generation deal with that. My guest with me here today, speaking from the older generation and joining us from Boston, is George Stock. He's a senior advisor for the Boston Group, and he's written on many different articles on a lot of different topics, but he wrote an article recently on family-owned businesses. George Stock, glad to have you with us here today.
Great to be here.
And our middle generation guest in studio with me is Sarah Keithley, and she's one of the owners and general manager of Cantrell Service Center here in North Little Rock. The business was established in 1971 by Daryl Patterson, her father, and she started working for the business back in 2005 and took over as general manager there. And she'll tell us a little bit more about how that came about also. Sarah, glad to have you with me here today.
Nice to be here.
And then joining us from his farm is Josh Harden. He's the son of Randy Harden from Scott, Arkansas, and they, along with Randy's father, operate Harden Farms. He's been involved with that all his life. And Josh, glad to have you with us here today.
Thank you very much.
I do want to begin the program with a question to you, George. As you look over family-owned businesses from a historical standpoint, can you kind of just get us started on the nature of family-owned businesses from our national perspective?
Well, first, they actually are a big part of our corporate America. I mean, like 60% of the companies in the U.S. are family-owned companies. And you go outside the U.S., it's even higher. Like in Korea, it's 100%, almost 100%. And Indonesia, Japan, South Africa, South America, Brazil, Chile. This is the predominant form of corporate organization. And the U.S. actually doesn't really think about it that way. They think about everything being corporate. So that's one point I'd like to make. The second point, which I think is probably the intergenerational thing, is that there's a lot of myth around the third generation failing. So it's called Shirley's in three generations. And my belief, after having worked in this area for like 10 years straight, is that the third generation doesn't really fail. It's actually the second generation that fails to prepare the third generation. And so the really successful family businesses I've seen have been businesses where the second generation has taken an interest in making sure that the third generation is prepared to lead the business. And I think that's really the big issue here. And you get some really successful businesses like Koch Industries and Cargill that are huge and family controlled.
Do they somewhat go beyond three generations? Is there somewhat of a database or a cache of businesses that go four, five, six generations deep?
Mostly in Europe and Asia, you can find a lot of six and seven generation families. It gets very complicated because, like, for example, in Europe, I'm working with one company right now. It's a consumer durables company where there's 300 owners, and that's very complicated because it's exponential. By the fourth and fifth generation, you have lots of people who own the share of the company, unless the family decides on the second and third generation to contain ownership, which few companies do, but it's possible. You can actually say, I'm not going to allow my ownership base to expand. I'm going to keep it concentrated in one family.
Well, let me move to Sarah Keithley with a question for her generation. Sarah, I understand you can tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the business in the beginning, because I really, from what I understand, your father had it, and you sort of inherited it, not necessarily by choice?
That is correct, yes. I actually started working with my dad in 2005. Previous to that, I worked for International Paper and did a lot of customer service and accounting, bookkeeping kind of jobs. He asked me to come and work with him when he got ill. He was sick. I mean, I agreed to come, and when I came, I thought this was going to be a short-term thing. And turned out that I stayed for several years with him. He passed away in 2008, and I took over at that point. So,
and you have two sisters, right?
I have two sisters. I was going to say, we have three owners, and that's complicated. So I can imagine 300 would be very complicated.
Now, was it your dad's intention to have a family-owned business, or how did that happen that you turned into a family-owned business?
I don't think so. We are an automotive repair business that he started as a partnership originally, and he worked in it, you know, for 40 years. So he really grew the business and did a really good job at growing the business. But as his children, you know, we were all girls, so he had no boys to really leave it to. So I really don't think he expected that to happen. We certainly didn't expect it. I didn't expect it to happen. But the way it just kind of came to be, it worked out. And I think he was really happy that it worked out that way and someone did take over the business from the family. But I don't think that was really his intent.
Well, let me bring Josh into it also here at the early stages here. Josh Harden, how did your family's farm end up being a family-owned farm business? Does it go how many generations does it go back?
Well, I'm the fifth generation, and we've been a, you know, mid-sized production farm for the better part, about 3 to 4 generations of that. You know, I mean, it started on the original land, but by the second, third generation, it began to expand, and, you know, and that's really was the most successful era of agriculture on our farm and kind of the beginning of commercial agriculture during the 50s and 60s. There was an abundance of labor, not necessarily slave labor, but there was just a lot of cheap labor during that time, depression, post-depression era, and there was just a lot of people that needed to work, and that, I think, fueled, you know, mid-sized family farms, and, you know, it was all family-owned farms back then. There wasn't really a lot of corporate interest yet into agriculture. That was still very new, you know, and so it was still, you know, mostly families who were taking the risk, getting small loans from banks.
Let me come back to you, George Stock, and ask the question about why do you choose to follow within the family? How do you reason those decisions?
Well, I think observing the families I work with, there is an immense loyalty to legacy, to their parents. Very often the business carries the family name, and people are incredibly devoted to making this happen. Doesn't mean they're necessarily qualified, but they're devoted, and they want to be part of it, and they want to go forward. And I think they deserve a lot of chance. I mean, I work a lot with corporate companies, too. There's something about the dedication to the family ideals. I like this business. I like to be in this market. I like to do this for my customers. That's really cool. It gets carried through in the family. And so we see a lot of family second and third generation want to be involved. And they should be.
Sarah, since you mentioned that you didn't expect to get in the family business, what did you expect that your life was going to do, and how did you make that adjustment to not doing that?
I'm not sure. I don't think that at the time when I came to work for my dad, I actually had left International Paper. My kids were both in college, and I had started a program as a pastry chef, which is what I thought I really wanted to do, was become a pastry chef at that point. So I had done that for a little over a year when my dad started to get sick and asked me to come to work for him. So I was really reluctant, you know, to stop where I was and to do that. It's really funny that he talked about loyalty, because once my dad passed away, me and both of my sisters felt really strongly, and we talked about it, you know, really strongly about what happened to the business. And we really felt strongly that we wanted to carry that on for him because he had worked so hard for it. So it was really kind of a decision, do we want to carry this on ourselves? And we decided, yes, that we did. And it turns out it was great for me because I really enjoy it. And I think it was really something that was meant for me. So,
what about your sisters?
Your older sister?
They're both. No, I'm the youngest, actually.
You are?
No kidding.
I am.
Oh, wow.
I have two older sisters, but they're both very set in their careers. One is a financial manager for Axiom, and the other one is an engineer at the time she was with Altel. So they were pretty set in their careers, where I was kind of in a mode of change. So that's the reason he came to me, I think.
Well, that surprises me, Sarah. I would have just assumed that you were probably the oldest sister and you took over the business.
Now I'm the youngest.
Well, how about that? Well, Josh Harden, talk to me about when you decided to stay within the family business, or is this something that the loyalty factor is what motivates you too?
Well, I think like Sarah said, it wasn't something I planned on. I had actually kind of grown up in the city and not on the farm, just came to visit on the farm in the summers. You know, my parents were separated when I was pretty young, and so, you know, it was interesting a little bit, but, you know, when you're young, the farm, especially a mid-sized farm, it was just not really conducive to play. It was a really serious environment. I never really saw that as a direction to go in. You know, it really took over the years me realizing that I had really picked up a lot of these skills and these talents to grow, and just the passion for food and for farmers markets, and just in general, it really hit me, you know, this is what I know, you know, and I really should go further and find more of my own personal self, you know, in the business, to see how far I could take that interest. That's kind of what led me to realize I'm a farmer, you know, and I have to just be a farmer. And I've done a lot of other things to stay a farmer. I think most farmers do. We have a lot of other jobs, but the family business has always been, you know, kind of a place to rally for all of us, and to a reason to fight, you know, just a reason to come together. I think that throughout our history of our family, that's kind of what the farm has been. It's our table to kind of come together and fight our differences as a family that we have. It's always kind of given us the motivation to, especially in agriculture, to really do have to fight to keep it going. You know, it's daily struggle, and so you got to have the ability to kind of rise above, I think, differences and personal ideas, and really work as a unit. I think that's something we've struggled to come together sometimes, and that really can hurt business. But I'm more and more confident, you know, as each year goes by, I realize I really can do this. And as the younger generation, it has taken time to kind of gain that confidence, feel like, okay, I can make decisions on my own, still with the guidance of my father. And
well, you're kind of leading me to the question for you. Where are you on the totem pole of power within the family organization, being the younger generation?
Well, and that's kind of happening daily right now. You know, we've really, you know, just over the last couple of years, I purchased my own farm. I'd been on the family farm for several years, and I purchased my own land north of town, just about 30, 40 miles near the city, near where our markets are. And, you know, and since then, I've actually grown closer to the family business. That might sound strange, but kind of drawn me back to it as I've gained my independence and worked hard and kind of formed a small farm. My father has kind of taken note of that and wanted me to be more a part of helping and kind of continuing the traditions of fruit and vegetable farming within the structure of the family.
I'd like to hear them talk about their next generation, their kids, and what they're doing to prepare the kids to either be in the business or be successful on their own. That, to me, is the biggest challenge that both family founders and company owners face. Will my kids be successful?
For us, you know, it's interesting, when this opportunity came up, it really got me thinking about the third generation, and we really haven't addressed that because we've just now kind of gotten into the second generation. But as far as my children, they're both, my son is a pharmacist, and then my daughter is getting her PhD in engineering. So I doubt seriously either of those have an interest in running the business. They may at some point, kind of like me. I didn't expect it either.
Right.
My nephew is 14, so he's got a little ways to go. My niece is older, but she has no interest in that. It's interesting that we haven't really started to think about that.
From my perspective, what happens is it sneaks up on you really fast. I mean, you could sort of, on Monday, I'm not going to worry about it, right? A year from Monday, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Sort of in the same way you inherited it from your father, who had a sudden problem.
Right.
Right.
That's just like my two sisters don't work in the business. They do have a third of the ownership. So they definitely do have some say-so in how the business is run and what happens to the business, property and land as well, building and land as well. You know, as it passes on to the next generation, then, like you say, you begin to get more and more owners, because now you have four more owners and you may not have any of those who actually want to work in the business. So, yeah, it's something we haven't really considered.
Sarah, did you have to train yourself in a really fast curve?
I did. We struggled after my dad passed away. We struggled that first year, definitely. The second year, we did a little bit better, and we've done a little bit better every year since. So we definitely are making progress, but we did struggle that first year.
Well, Josh, tell me about, as George is talking there, your training or the training of your generation.
my father was always wanted us to get as far away from the farm as we could, you know,
really?
Because he saw it as a very difficult way of life, and, you know, everybody's against the farmer. And, I mean, when you're in commodities and you're in, you know, you're trying to be in the large-scale agriculture, it really can appear that way, that everybody's kind of out to destroy you, you know. And so, you know, I think he always pushed us to get educated and get out there and be something, make something out of yourself. Don't be a farmer. And, you know, my brother and I both have returned to agriculture, to his chagrin. You know, we have both gotten educations and realized that we could make a better way, you know, in agriculture. We could put some sustainable, you know, principles to work on the land, and that we could ensure our future by really standing up for certain practices on the land, becoming better stewards. You know, I own an organic farm, and that's something really, for me, I'm really passionate about training the next generation. And I think it starts with building a type of farm that is inviting, you know, that people want to come and visit and bring their children to. And, you know, and that was kind of what my father had as well. We've had agritourism on the farm, and he kind of changed the perspective of the public to larger farms. Had a pumpkin patch there for 20-plus years, and, you know, and brought thousands of people onto the farm. And, you know, and I think that for me is the most important thing we can do as farmers is to not create farms that are unapproachable, making them not necessarily picture-perfect farms. I don't want a postcard farm, but I want something that's not deadly, you know, and that a family wants to come visit.
George, let me ask you about, let's say we have a situation where the father or grandfather has started the business and it's gone on and into the second, third, maybe even fourth generation as he sees his grandchildren coming along. How does the person who started the business leave the business?
That's a great question. One of the things we try to do is we try to help people decide when they're about 50 what their exit path is, because a lot of these founders will hang on to their 70s and they really have no alternative. But the business, and we try to help them say, you're not going to leave the business, you're going to actually go someplace else and do something different. And that really opens the mind. I think in this conversation, we don't have a situation where any fathers need to be shown the door, but the door should be a grand door in the sense that we're going to something bigger and better. And that's really a big transition for people to make. To let go of the business and say, okay, I'm 65, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go into politics, I'm going to be a civic leader, I'm going to be a charitable thing, I'm going to actually start another business sometimes.
Well, George, how often do you think that's a successful transition?
Not very often. I would say 2 out of 5 times.
Well, on those other three, what happens to the family business?
Well, the founder dies and somebody takes control. We've heard that story. The founder steps aside and lets somebody, you know, the younger generation take control, but he's still, he or she, very often it's happened to be she, still meddles in the business. But it really starts, you know, people really need to start thinking about this around their 50s and saying, how am I going to get ready for the next generation? It could be non-family, too. I mean, I have a situation right now where the company's growing faster than the family, and so we have to train next generation of management, which is non-family, to take control of this company, because the family cannot maintain control. They're just not big enough.
Well, Sarah, is that something you've thought about as maybe the non-family successor?
We do have an employee now that has been part, sort of like family, for a long time, that is a very young gentleman. He's 26, 27, and we have talked amongst ourselves, me and my sisters, and with him about the possibility of him becoming, you know, stepping into those shoes as we step out, depending on where everything falls. But, you know, I'm approaching 50. So as a second generation, we need to start talking about third generation and start to make a plan on what are we going to do when I'm ready to retire or when it's time for me to step away.
Do you think you'd have a hard time letting go of the reins?
I definitely do. I've not been there long enough. Maybe by that time, I wouldn't have a difficult time. But now, you know, I'm really enjoying the fact that we've been able to not only maintain the business, but to grow it. And we're seeing a lot of growth and a lot of changes and a lot of things. It's funny because when I look at it, I think if my dad were still here, which of course I wish he was, it would be much different. The changes that we have made since he passed away probably would have been much slower or much different had he still been alive because of his input, because of his, you know, because even though he wasn't working a lot when I was there, the couple of years that I worked for him, he was still very much in control. So I think it would have been much different.
Would he be proud of what you've done?
I certainly hope so, yes.
Yeah, sounds like it. Part of Next Generation is not necessarily management, but owners, teaching them to be owners. One of the problems I run into a lot is that there are families that own the business but don't know how to be owners, and they behave badly. They say things to the business that are non-constructive. They criticize executives, and they need to recognize that actually they have a position more like a board of director member, and they can direct the business, but they can't meddle in it. And so preparing the next generation to be good owners, which means understanding financial statements, understanding perspectives, understanding the legalities of trust, if there's trust involved. And all too often I see people underinvest in the next generation in terms of getting them prepared to be good owners. That's a basic. And if they become managers or executives, that's great, but not necessarily.
Well, Josh, do you have a sense of ownership in the family business, or are you still part of the learning part of it, or you're just getting into it? Do you have a sense of ownership?
I do, most definitely. I have kind of earned my little part of ownership of the larger farm. You know, my father is 64, 65. And I think that's something in agriculture that's probably unique, is that, you know, 50 is not even close to you know, when you're farming. That's like, you know, the halfway point. My grandfather is 94.
And he's still, wow.
You're on the farm, you know, he still pulls up and points and wants things done, you know. And I mean, so it really, you know, agriculture is not like a lot of business, not as cut and dry, you know. It's like, this is the end of one stint and the beginning of the next, you know. We really stand on each other's shoulders daily and have to, you know, and have to deal with the vision that we each have, a vision, you know, and that we kind of work on our own things, but, you know, we're all working with a common goal to keep the farm, you know, keep the utilities paid and the salaries paid of the workers and those things. We kind of unite on those principles, but it's a challenge to find.
So I suppose when Grandpa pulls up on the job, everybody hops too, right?
Right, yeah. And I mean, he's getting older where he's not, you know, he doesn't have the reins like he did 10 or 15 years ago, mm-hmm. still, but even in his 70s and 80s, he was a big part of the management of the farm. You know, mm-hmm. my father really struggled with him to make big decisions and to, you know, to further things that he saw happening that my grandpa couldn't see, you know, because of his age. I see myself in that same position now, where I see things that I really feel like we should be doing, and slow to make that change happen. It really takes doing it on a small scale and kind of doing case studies of crops and different methods and kind of proving myself and gaining, you know, getting those doors open.
Is it at all political?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, when there's money involved, it's always political.
Well, speaking of money, George, I want to come back to you and have you take an overview of the economy we've just come through, the hard times that were there, the changes in family-owned businesses, and kind of looking ahead a little bit. From an economical standpoint, where does the family-owned business look like it's headed?
Well, a couple of points I'd like to make. One is, actually, we did a project, the Boston Consulting Group. We looked at family companies. We looked at them over two cycles of economic change. And most people, when they look at family companies and public companies, look at it at a point in time and say, who's more profitable, who's better performing? And that's the mistake. If you look over the cycles, you see something very different, which is family companies actually don't make as much money in the boom times, but don't lose as much in the bad times. And so if you integrate it over the cycles, they actually come out ahead of the public companies. And it's a fascinating story. Basically, family companies are very conservative about their finances. They're risk-averse. They are careful about diversifying, but they try to diversify closely to their core, and they do quite well. Part of what's called the long-term vision of family companies is that they're afraid to walk away from their mistakes, which is a big, sometimes a big problem. But they do stick with businesses and try to recover them. So that's one critical issue I've noticed over time. Now, the big issue for family companies, if I can pontificate here for a moment, is that the business models that are successful today have a life cycle of about 10 years. They used to have a life cycle of about 30 years. And a lot of family-owned companies I work with are living off the past business cycle, or you know, business life cycle, and they're not seeing the change that's going to hit them. And the change is huge. And I'm sure if we talk about farming, maybe automotive components, things are happening really fast now. And so the families have to face up to a business cycle that's going to move. And the founders, the generation N minus one, the older generation, is not ready to make that change. Generation N or N plus one is not prepared. And they got to be prepared because it's going to hit them hard.
Well, Josh, he's talking right to you and what you mentioned earlier about you see some changes that you'd like to make. And, George, are you saying that Josh, in his young position, should act on those perceptions
well,
of change?
I don't know Josh that well or his business that well, but I suspect he's describing a situation that says the business is changing. And his grandfather was brilliant. His father was brilliant. But their brilliance isn't going to solve the today's problems.
Absolutely. I mean, the small farm is the quickest dying family business of the whole group, you know, because of the huge mountain, you know, that we face, the financing challenges, the weather risk, you know, just insurance, and just in general, it's very difficult for one human to withstand all the things that it takes to get a farm. You know, our farm is 1,600 acres, you know, and it takes nothing short of a bank to put this together every year. You know, we don't have a lot of credit. You know, we really do this by the skin of our teeth, you know, and so it's a real fight to make change at the same time you're trying to keep the business open, you know, and it really, that's the part of a farm where it becomes very dangerous when you can't adapt and keep your employees paid and keep the labor working, but at the same time being, you know, making forward progress, adapting to things. And that's been a real challenge for me. You know, it's taken every ounce of strength I have to just bring a little bit of change and to prove that we have that change is necessary. Just to make that case has been a challenge in itself.
If you did the history of his farm, he will be a pivotal player. The family will make a major transition because of Josh. Josh is raising the right questions, which is, do we keep the business or not? If the whole world's going to large corporate farms, maybe it's time to sell out, deal with the family issues. The you know, it's really interesting watching the next generation in these family businesses is they don't know they're being put on stage, but they are being put on stage. They're going to be the pivotal leaders. They're going to make decisions, and they're going to, if you lay out the family history, often they will be the people that made the big difference.
Well, folks, we've enjoyed talking about the family-owned businesses here today on our program, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Many of you listening may be involved in a family-owned business. I hope this has been helpful for you, too. And if you are, think about that next generation, whatever your generation may be yourself. I do want to thank my guests for being with me here today. That last voice you heard was George Stock. He's a senior advisor with Boston Group, written many different articles about this topic and work with a lot of different companies in family-owned businesses. George, thanks so much for being with us here today.
Great. I enjoyed talking to you all.
And our middle generation guest has been Sarah Keithley. She's one of the owners, she and her two sisters, of the Cantrell Service Center in North Little Rock. Sarah Keithley, thanks for being with me here today.
Thank you.
And then Josh Harden, you've been out on the farm. I know you've got to go back out in today's heat and get back out in there again, but I do want to thank you. You're the son of Randy Harden, and you're from Scott, and you guys operate Harden Farms. Josh, thanks again for being with me here, too.
And that was Grady, Arkansas.
Oh, you're in Grady. Okay. So, is the family a part of Scott, too? You guys must be everywhere.
That's just one of our many businesses.
All right.
Okay, well, folks, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, which is about another 20 minutes or so, you'll be able to find that on our podcast at KUER.org. Again, thanks for listening, and join us next week. We'll see you then.